Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Taha Lokhandwala, Deputy Personal Finance Editor at Investors Chronicle. And joining me today are Emma Adjerman, Personal Finance Writer, and James Tom, Manager at Aberdeen New Dawn Investment Trust. Welcome everyone. Global markets are not having the best of time in 2018. So far this year, emerging markets and Asia in particular have seen a lot of volatility. This has been associated with uncertainty over the Chinese economy and trade wars stemming from the US. This week, negative investor sentiment on Turkey and Argentina, stemming from the country's currency issues and sharp rises in interest rate, has started spreading to other emerging markets across the globe and including Asia. This combined with some slightly worrying Chinese economic data to make it a difficult week for Asian stocks in general. James, your trust invests in Asia-Pacific ex-Japan. Could you explain to us why the issues in Turkey and Argentina have started affecting stocks in your region?
Well, I think it's certainly creating a degree of negative sentiment across emerging markets. We've seen this play out before multiple times as a currency crisis in one emerging market then spreads across the globe to other emerging markets. So I think there's naturally a concern that this may be history repeating itself and hence some caution when it comes to Asian markets. And we're seeing that most evidently in Indonesia and in India at the moment, where the currencies are under pressure. Having said that, I don't want to say that this time it's different, but I think there are reasons to be somewhat positive that the economic fundamentals in Asia are in much better health today than they were, say, 5 years ago when we had the taper tantrum and some wobbles on the currencies then. So when you look at the macroeconomic indicators, whether it's current account deficits, fiscal deficits, inflation, FX reserves, all of those measures have improved in Asia in recent years. And the result of that is that I think the Asian economies are far less vulnerable today than they were a few years ago, and really should be better placed to withstand this sort of pressure on their currencies.
Okay, given that we've kind of seen this this kind of stuff before, obviously we can't predict the future, but how bad can it get for those who are holding Asian equities, and what should they be doing while this is going on? Obviously, it's quite nerve-wracking to see markets as volatile.
Yes, and there are, I mean, I think it's not just the contagion issue. There are other headwinds that are buffeting the Asian markets currently. And you mentioned in your opening remarks about the trade tensions on China, the stronger US dollar and slowing growth. So there are multiple reasons to be cautious. Having said that, I think when you drill down into the underlying fundamentals in Asia, there's no need to panic. And I've talked already about some of the sort of macroeconomic indicators, but down at the corporate level, and we spend our lives looking at the Asian companies, actually earnings growth is still pretty healthy. You know, we're just concluding the first half earnings season, and we're seeing kind of mid-teens rates of growth in earnings. That's pretty attractive. And I think if you are selective in Asia in terms of your stock picks, there are still very attractive opportunities where growth is good, balance sheets are still healthy, and valuations are getting cheaper.
Okay, so it's an interesting point because I think, as you said, the kind of macroeconomic situation and this contagion is kind of masking some decent fundamentals. But when you compare this year compared to, say, 2016, 2017, there were some really, really strong returns from Asia, you know, 60% over the course of 2016 and 2017. Have we seen the best of Asian returns for this cycle at least? This year obviously is very different. The markets are down so far year to date.
Yes, and the world has changed. You know, I think many of these headwinds that we've talked about are, you know, their origins lie in the US, and with President Trump's policies, those are that weren't there in 16 and 17, or at least not to the same extent. So Asian markets were able to come back quite nicely this year because of some of those policy changes. It's harder going. So I don't think, you know, we're not going to see another 16 and 17 type returns, which were quite exceptional years. But I don't think that's to say that the sort of long-term returns outlook for Asia is entirely diminished. As I say, if you believe through the sort of longer term that stock market returns should mirror or map earnings, as I've said, earnings growth is still pretty healthy. I think there are still decent returns to be made in Asia, but certainly for this year, it is harder going and it is volatile, and we're not going to have quite the same high returns that we have enjoyed in the last couple of years.
Okay, great. Two of the biggest economies in the region are, of course, China and India, also the two largest regional allocations in your fund. Both have some kind of significant issues to overcome in terms of the kind of the economy, in terms of China and politically in India. So can you talk us through what we might see in future in terms of these individual countries and how this might translate to into volatility and returns?
Well, let me take China first, because that's front and center of the current sell-off in Asian markets, and that's being really driven by the trade tensions. That's understandably causing a lot of uncertainty. It's bad for sentiment. But again, I'm coming back to the fundamentals. And if you look at what the actual impact of these tariffs may be on the Chinese economy, it's perhaps not as bad as the market sell-off would suggest. And this is not our data. I'm drawing on sort of IMF and third-party data. But the estimates are that if all the tariffs currently on the table get implemented, that may knock about 50 basis points or 0.5% off China's aggregate demand. And bear in mind, you know, China is still growing at 6.5%. So China can certainly absorb that sort of hit. It's also letting the trading bans on its currency widen, and we're seeing a depreciation in the local Chinese currency, and that may end up offsetting quite a bit of the pressure from higher tariffs. And then down at the corporate level again, and I always bring it back to that, there's actually fairly little direct exposure to the US economy in terms of sales and earnings in the listed space in China. It's something, well, less than 2% of sales, I think, by some estimates, are direct to the US. So there's a degree of insulation there. And that, I think, is why we're continuing to see very healthy earnings growth in China as well. And from our perspective as stock pickers, we've been acting on that opportunistically to buy more of the companies that we like in China, and just to increase our exposure to that market, because we believe that the long-term story structurally in China is very much intact. It's still, you know, a market where you're seeing rising wealth levels, a lot of excitement in the technology and internet sector, as you're seeing elsewhere in the world. But China is a pioneer in many respects in that sector. So there are still very attractive investment opportunities, and we're very focused on those. So that's China. Turning to India. Actually, so India, it's important to sort of dissect the returns a little bit there. I mentioned earlier that that India and Indonesia have been bearing the brunt of the contagion kind of issue in terms of currency weakness. So the Indian rupee has depreciated quite substantially in recent months, but the domestic stock market returns have actually been very healthy. So in US dollar or sterling terms, perhaps you're not getting the overall return because of the currency impact, but the fact that the domestic market has been pretty healthy tells you something about the corporate earnings outlook and the sort of positive things that are going on at an economic level in India still. There are a couple of headwinds looming. You know, the higher oil price isn't great for India. It's a net importer of oil. So then that may trigger a little bit of inflationary pressure. But the central bank's responding to that with higher interest rates. The country goes to the polls next year, the outcome of that is looking less straightforward than it had done a few quarters back.
Indeed. This is actually one of the things I wanted to bring up. Obviously, a lot of the Indian returns we've seen over the last few years have come from kind of Modi's policies. There is now an increasing risk that Modi will not win the next election. Is that something that is on your radar and concerns you in terms of the outlook for Indian stocks?
To some extent, I mean, we build our portfolios from the bottom up, so we're really just trying to find good quality companies and invest in those, hopefully at reasonable valuations. And you've always got to keep an eye on the politics and the macro environment. But for us, it's the companies that are the core focus. And India is still, for us, a great hunting ground, and we find plenty of good quality companies there, which is why we maintain a sizable position in India. But yes, I think where the sort of politics and the market kind of mix here is that it looks as if the sort of political risk around the election isn't being priced into the Indian market yet. As I said, it's been really very resilient, still posting positive returns. So I think as we get nearer to the general election, and we've got various state elections ahead of that, we may see a little bit of a pullback as expectations kind of adjust. You know, that's probably not a bad thing as far as it goes for Indian equities. They are fairly fully valued at the moment. Valuations, certainly relative to the rest of the region, are quite high. So to take a little bit of heat out of the market may not be all bad.
No, definitely. No, it's been interesting to hear your views on this region. So obviously, you mentioned that the long-term fundamentals for a lot of the region remains quite strong. Thinking slightly more short-term, which I appreciate isn't your game, but do you think for the rest of the year things might settle down in the coming months, or should we be belting up for more volatility and perhaps even using this as an opportunity to buy if that works?
Well, it's always difficult to predict, and really we're not in the game of predicting where markets are going to go. And I think in this case, if you look at what those headwinds are, so much of it, as I said earlier, is being driven by US policy and President Trump. And you know, everyone's trying to second guess him and understand what's coming next. It may be, you know, maybe the trade tensions with China will be wrapped up tomorrow, when we'll have a sort of NAFTA type deal that is done overnight, and all of this will sort of disappear. Or maybe it'll roll on for another 6 months, a year. It's very difficult to predict. I think the base case has to be that the volatility will continue. But I do see that as a buying opportunity. And as I said, that is what we've been doing, buying into companies that we've had on our radar for some time and have always liked, but perhaps, you know, the valuations have been too inflated. So this has given us an opportunity to buy into new stocks, and also just to buy more of what we like already in the portfolio, the sort of highest quality names that we have there, and just build up those positions at attractive valuations.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. So elsewhere this week, we had some news that Terry Smith, founder of the imaginatively named Fundsmith, is planning to launch a new investment trust. This would be addition to his open-ended fund, Fundsmith Equity, which I'm sure many listeners are familiar with, and his Fundsmith Emerging Markets Equity Investment Trust. Mr. Smith is known for his slow and steady approach to investing, buying quality companies and holding them for a long time, low turnover, low trading, and it has worked if you look at his performance. So Emma, what has this new investment trust got in store for us?
Well, interestingly, Taha, this new investment trust is going to be focusing more on small and mid caps, because as you mentioned, Fundsmith tends to focus much more on large caps. And so this fund is going to be focusing on global small caps, but they're defining those as between $500 million and $15 billion. So there's quite a lot of scope for the kind of companies they can choose. But it will be investing on the same kind of strategy that Mr. Smith has used in his other funds, namely that quality-focused buy and hold strategy. It's going to be quite a concentrated level of stocks as well, up to about 40 stocks initially when the fund launches. But, you know, crucially, this fund, although it's going to have Mr. Smith's name on it, it's called Smith Sons Investment Trust. It's not actually going to be run by him. It's going to be run by two managers who've joined his firm in the last year or so.
Oh, so that's quite interesting. So it's something slightly different from Fundsmith there. Interesting that it's a slightly concentrated portfolio of only 25 to 40 stocks as well. That's interesting to see how that works. What about charging? It sounds like Fundsmith are going to be doing something slightly different. Could you explain a bit more about this, please?
Yeah, that's right. Normally, trusts tend to price their annual management charges on net asset value of the trust. But this trust is actually going to be doing that on the market capitalization of the trust. and the annual management charge is going to be 0.9%, and it's going to be based on the share price. So that is quite a different way of doing things. And some of the analysts I spoke to said that in some senses it could be act as an incentive for the trust not to trade on a discount, as it was going to align shareholders with the managers to make sure that that doesn't happen. But on the negative side of things, you know, if the trust is going to trade on a premium, which is likely given Mr. Smith's strong following among investors, that potentially is going to make it more expensive than if it was priced on net asset value.
That's quite interesting. Yeah, the strong following there is a quite an interesting point. His emerging market equity trust has underperformed, yet still manages to trade on a premium. So something to watch out for with this one as well. So why now? What's prompted Terry Smith and Fund Smith to do this? And how do we think it'll do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely going to be popular. I certainly imagine it getting off the ground. I mean, I think that the reason for this, a couple of points. Fund Smith Equity has grown to be an absolutely massive fund, £18 billion of assets. And that means that it's actually much harder for the fund to invest in smaller companies, because even 1% position in any of these companies is going to be 180 million, which is pretty much going to take up the majority of shares of a smaller company. And Mr. Smith thinks that actually small and medium sized companies tend to do a lot better in terms of their overall performance. So this is an opportunity that he wants to tap with this new investment trust, which, as it's going to be investing in smaller companies and it's not so big, will be able to take advantage of global opportunities in small mid caps. So just to give you an idea of the kind of performance that we've seen from these types of stocks, over the past 10 years, the MSCI World Small and Mid Cap Index has returned 230%, and that's compared to 185% by the MSCI World Index. So, you know, there is a strong trend of small and medium-sized companies doing better.
Okay. Yeah, it's certainly interesting. It's interesting because I think most small-cap managers that we are familiar with tend to be quite active with their holdings, and they change things as prices are quite volatile. They also own a lot of stocks to diversify risk and liquidity, but I suppose that's where the investment trust can come into its own. What do you think about this? Is there a risk he's overstretching himself? Something not in his forte? I mean, Neil Woodford launched a small cap trust and that hasn't worked out very well. So
So far, at least not so well for Woodford Patient Capital. But, you know, the clue's in the title. So, you know, let's give him a little bit longer potentially. It's an interesting question. I think that it's notable that this trust is not directly going to be run by Terry Smith. He's got a couple of managers who seem to have more expertise in small cap investing, but he will still be involved with the trust. He says he's going to be giving them advice and support. And actually, something else which I think our listeners will find interesting is that he's actually committing £25 million of his own money to launch this trust. So, you know, he really is putting his money where his mouth is. As to whether or not he's overstretching, I mean, it's one to watch, but I certainly think it's an interesting proposition and I'm sure it's going to be popular.
Okay, great. And what about the analysts? What's the consensus coming from them?
Consensus is, you know, pretty similar, actually, that they do think that this trust is going to be serving an interesting space because there's not too many trust focusing on global, smaller and mid-cap companies. So in that sense, it's going to be interesting. Obviously, Terry Smith's investment style has proved very successful. So they think that's also going to be a key positive for the trust. And this different proposition with the fees should also be an interesting feature, which they think investors are likely to like.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for that, Emma. Moving on, something slightly different this week. We're going to talk about annuities. Emma's been looking at these. These are insurance products which you buy with your pension pots. Either that could be a self-invested personal pension, a SIP, or a defined contribution scheme provided by your employer. And what it does, it gives you guaranteed income for life. You basically take your DC pot, you purchase an annuity, and it almost converts it into a DB pot, I suppose is the easiest way to explain this. They were legally mandated for most savers before 2015, and then the government changed the rules. And since, their popularity has plummeted and the market has shrunk. It kind of makes sense. Most people prefer the flexibility you can get away from annuities. Once you buy them and convert them into annuity, you can't change that. You can't go back. Also, the level of income you've got from annuities has been pretty poor over the past decade. This is because they are priced using interest rates, which, of course, we all know have been quite low for quite some time. However, though, it's interesting because there's a lot of market research out there about what people want from pensions. And when you ask them to design a pension product from scratch, they actually end up designing something quite close to annuities. So the benefits seem to have been overlooked by quite a lot of people. Emma, you've looked at the current market. Is there any reason for this popularity to perhaps change?
Well, a key reason for the potential change is that we've seen a interest rate rise in the last few months. And if we're likely to get further rate rises, that would potentially have a increase on gilt yields, which are used to price annuities. And therefore, we might get slightly better rates. And as you say, investors of all, in some senses, they don't like the brand of annuity. They actually do quite like what an annuity gives, which is guaranteed income for life. And actually, the number of providers in this market, of all the number, has shrunk. They've actually got more competitive in terms of what they're offering investors, as much lower spread between what's available. So arguably, the market's improved a little bit as well.
Sounds like they can be used then. As you see, most people prefer some flexibility. So is there a way perhaps people should be thinking about using annuities in a flexible way?
Yeah, I think the a key thing to do is maybe to consider using an annuity to cover some of your costs in retirement. So rather than taking your whole pension pot and buying an annuity with the whole of it, you could use part of a pot to cover fixed expenses that you're going to have in retirement. So if you've got a smaller pot, for example, under £50,000, it's not going to be that cost effective to go into income drawdown, as the costs of that are quite high relative to what you're going to get out of it. So in that sense, it might be a good idea to use an annuity.
Okay, great. And what about the opposite? There's a reason annuity sales have dropped off so much, so there must be times when it's a bad idea. When should we not be using them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you've got, you know, really large pots which could do well in income drawdown, that's something to consider. Also, if you've got lots of other sources of guaranteed income, so if you've got defined benefit, final salary pension schemes, that you might not need more guaranteed income, in which case it's better to use your DB pension schemes to provide that, the expenses, fixed expenses you have in retirement, and maybe to use income drawdown so that you've got more flexibility in general of how you spend your money. Another interesting reason why an annuity might not be so good is because if you plan to pass on your pension to your heirs when you die, annuities are not very good for that, because basically once you die, the income that you get goes with you unless you've specifically selected some death benefits. And in contrast, if you're going to choose a defined contribution pension, you are actually able to pass this on to your heirs. So that could be another reason when an annuity is not so good.
Thanks for that, Emma. That's really interesting. Also, Emma has very kindly researched some useful tips on the best ways to make sure you get the most value out of your annuity, and also looked at what providers are offering at the moment. So some comprehensive data in the magazine and on the website. So please go and take a look at that. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week, but please don't forget to check out this week's issue online or in print. You can read more about everything we've talked about today. Also, our usual fun tips, portfolio clinic, some companies news, and there's a feature on investing in Japan. But that's all for today. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good weekend.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.